Hour two of the truth with Sherwin Hughes. For those that are inquiring, this is Clarissa. I interviewed her in studio a couple months ago, and I saw her perform at Shakers last weekend, two weekends ago. She never disappoints. She is touring the East Coast right now. I'll let you guys know when she's back in town. All right. I want to read some of these YouTube comments because what are y'all drinking this morning? And it ain't coffee. I don't know what it is about my broadcast, whether it's here on 101.7 The Truth or on my YouTube channel, Hughes Views 414, where people don't want to be sober when they're interacting with me. There's something about my style and my delivery of communication where people are like, I got to get drunk for this. And I think I'm going to call in while I'm drunk. Anka GED Productions 414 says, vote Kel DeRoy's. Whites will never trust Crowley. So Kelda's campaign strategy, which is just as weird as she is, and I don't use weird in a derogatory way. She's a very unconventional woman with a tremendous amount of confidence. A video that she put out maybe last weekend made its rounds on social media. It's an hour long of her in her kitchen wearing a bandana like Fran in her hair. And she's making spaghetti. And there's someone off camera asking her questions about the race. And asking her questions about the issues. One positive thing I can say about her is she knows the issues very, very well. She's a very, very intelligent legislator. No doubt about it. Her political and campaign instincts, awful, tarnished, very bad. But it's difficult for... So you know how some people are type A and type B? It's really, really hard for someone who is like a savant on the issues. Like they know the science of policy. And a lot of people don't. Donald Trump doesn't know the science of policy. Donald Trump only talks about and discusses things that make sense to him. And that's a very, very narrow worldview. You know that there was almost a bipartisan bill. Democrats and Republicans were coming together in the House of Representatives and in the U.S. Senate to advance a bipartisan bill to increase the supply of affordable housing in the country. It actually was a really, really nice piece of legislation. Donald Trump said he was not going to sign it, not because he didn't like the details of it, not because it cost too much, none of that, because he said it bored him. It bored, he was bored by a housing bill.
And the Save America Act.
So there are people that have a real profound understanding of policy, but it's often difficult for them to become relatable. And they try really, really hard. You ever meet somebody who's like, otherworldly intelligent, like they just everything that they talk about is very complicated because they have such a profound understanding. They forget or they've never known. They're on the spectrum. Well, I mean, everybody's on the spectrum now, but they're so intelligent that they're off on an island on their own, and nobody even understands what the hell they're talking about because they find it impossible to be relatable. It's almost like they've traded charisma for a really high amount of intelligence. And you'll get people that know policy really, really well. I'm not saying that Kelda's a savant genius. I mean, she's smart. I think she's the only lawyer running. But she is not able to translate her understanding of the issues, understanding of policy, and the future of policy. Because what you support right now is going to look different when it's implemented in the future. Every policy that gets created right now gets morphed, changed, chopped up, fattened, or thinned out with each biennial budget that we have here in the state of Wisconsin. So how something starts is never how it is going to end. The starting point is just a glimmer. That is why when Francesca Hong says she wants to sunset or end the parental choice program, if she got elected governor, it would die. And we're going to talk about that because that's where I draw the line. If anybody thinks for a second that I will cast a vote for a person who wants to dismantle a program that the people whose shoulders that I stand on right here to be on air, they built that program over generations. Do you think that I would cast a vote for someone that wants to take it away? I simply cannot in good conscience or in good faith do that because a lot of those folks that came before me that put that program together, I'm going to see them again maybe one day at the pearly gates, and they're going to be very mad at me. And I want to be VIP in heaven. I want to sit in the front row. I want to have good seats.
Oh, you believe in that now?
And I want to stare down at earth. I'd rather believe in it a little bit than not believe in it and then find out when I get there, like, oh, sure, well, you should have believed. Now go that way. I just want to stare down at earth and watch it like a movie. You know what I mean? Just watch everybody go nuts over stupid stuff. So that's my position. Like, I'm not going to say, oh, well, she's going to do all these other stuff. You don't get to tear down what black people built in this state against all odds. That's a non-starter. And also, if she is ignorant of the program, which she clearly is, and does not want to educate herself and does not want to involve and engage herself in an issue that is central to the black community. Let me say what NPS is. NPS is, it's a flight that has been canceled or delayed. Now, eventually, you're going to get to your destination. Eventually, maybe these young people will learn how to read. Maybe eventually they'll get on grade level in math. Maybe eventually. Maybe eventually they'll get a high school diploma, or maybe when they're 27, they're 28. They'll get a GED. It is a flight that is delayed. The parental choice program is the airline saying, hey, you know what? We're going to find you another flight. We're going to put you on another airline because we want you to get to your destination quicker. Now, you can wait on this plane. You can sit standby for 3 days, for 4 days. You can. That's NPS. NPS is, well, just wait. We're going to do more funding. Just wait. We're going to fully fund public education. No, no, no. Just wait. We're going to get the kids on grade level. Sometimes you got to get to your destination. You can't wait. What the parental choice program is and what Francesca Hong still unabashedly says that she wants to destroy and dismantle is our flight to our destination. It's a rescheduled flight. If I'm flying Delta and Delta's like, yeah, we've had some issues here with the plane and we've got some issues with the crew. I mean, you can wait, of course. It might be a day or so. You know, we can put you up in a hotel. I guess we can make you comfortable while you wait. Or we can schedule you on this American Airlines flight, which leaves from Terminal 3 right now. Which one do you want to do? Only a fool will say, I'll just wait then for the Delta flight. I want the airline, which is NPS, if they are delaying the education of our children, which is delaying the workforce of the black community, which is delaying us being economically self-sufficient, I want the district itself to say, hey, you know what? There needs to be some alternatives because right now our flights are delayed. Now, we're going to put you on this little puddle jumper, but you're going to get to O'Hare safely and quickly. You're going to get there. Now, we know that it's inconvenient for you because you booked this flight, but this flight is delayed. Here's another option, and there is nothing wrong with that. But expecting me to cast a vote for the delayed flight and expecting me and us and our tax dollars to just wait is insane. And here's what else that's insane. You would never ask white folks to do that, ever. You would never ask them to wait. They're getting on that other flight. Oh, they're going to make you get them a connecting flight, as they should, as we should. And it's very, very simple. And I also come to find something out. There's a unity tour that's being planned in the state of Wisconsin, even though we don't know yet who's going to win the Democratic primary for governor. But there's already a plan in the works where all of these Democrats that are elected statewide and all over the place are going to travel the state with whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be. And the person that told me about this, they are a prominently elected Democrat, and they have some skepticism only because they know that if Francesca Hong becomes the Democratic nominee and there's this unity tour where all of these other, like, actual real Democrats are touring the state with her to show unity behind her, it's going to platform democratic socialism in such a way, it's going to obviously raise the profile of it. It's also going to allow someone who is a democratic socialist, not just here, but all over the country, to raise a lot more money, especially when you see unity, quote unquote unity, with other actual elected Democrats in the state. Here's why this person is worried, because he knows that he is going to have a democratic socialist opponent, even though he was invited to be a part of the unity tour. And he's got a, it's a very calculated risk. Do you help a democratic socialist raise more money? Because if you think they're going to stop with Francesca Hong, you must not know how they operate. They're going to run for everything, and they are going to run against African Americans. And quite honestly, maybe they should, because that's how they platform their legislative agenda, because Fran is going to need some support. Here's what you need to know. The way they came into the Midtown neighborhood and they shouted down what they said was a data center, even though it was not, they will go into black communities and they will have some of these white folks run in black neighborhoods and get elected in positions that black people are currently serving in, all in favor of a much more left-leaning agenda. And that's real. And because they don't spare anybody's feelings. They don't care about your feelings. They know that they are lacking in legislators. There's only three of them in 132 Wisconsin legislators. There are 33 senators and there are 99 members of the Wisconsin State Assembly. And in order for a democratic socialist governor to get legislation passed, they need more democratic socialist legislators. And they don't have them. And so they need them. So platforming Francesca allows democratic socialism to become much more mainstream. And when it becomes more mainstream, I'm going to say it. You ready for me to say it? I'm going to walk away from the mic and let you guys get a sip. I'm going to come back in a second. I'm going to say, hold on, let me get my coffee. I'll be right back. Don't go nowhere now. Once you start raising the profile of your political affiliation and start raising money, you become establishment. Because where do you think the money going to come from? Comes from the establishment. You think those sad, broke, rural, podunk white folks in Oklahoma and Kansas and North and South Dakota that are ardent Trump supporters, you think them rural white folks in Montana that still give Donald Trump an approval rating better than 50 or 51%, you think they got money to give to his campaign? You a new fool. Donald Trump's money comes from the establishment of the Republican Party. The establishment that at one point in time, the establishment of the Republican Party was never Trump. It was a whole cohort of people at the convention. They tried to take away Donald Trump's nomination. They tried to do, God bless them, what the Democrats did to Bernie. They tried to have, they formed another committee. They wanted to put together another rules session where they could actually find a loophole where they could stop Donald Trump from being the Republican nominee in 2016. Didn't work. The Democrats, though, did finagle the rules and stop Bernie Sanders from being the Democratic nominee because they knew what was going to happen. Democratic socialism, for what it's worth, if you look at it objectively, it's a virus. It can't really do much on its own. It's got to take advantage of the ineffectiveness of the Democratic Party and show up. The Democrats are losing. Kamala Harris lost. Donald Trump keeps winning. Donald Trump is a pedophile. We know all of those things. But what it's doing is it's saying we are better Democrats than Democrats can be. We're anti-establishment. We are for the common person, the working person who doesn't have, you know, a fair shake in the wages they get paid. And of course, healthcare is too expensive. And all of that stuff is believable and very, very relatable. But they have to latch on to the host. The host is the Democratic Party. That's the corporate structure. That's the money. That's the state party. That's the Democratic National Committee. They have to latch on to a host because a virus cannot survive on its own. It needs a host. I'll give you another example. I love the virus host scenario. When you get a virus, Your body responds to it by raising its core temperature. We know that as a fever because the virus can only survive in a very specific range of temperature. Can't survive on its own. It needs a host. And so what the host does is it raises its temperature to try and kill the virus. Now, we get really sick and we feel run down and we feel lousy and we have muscle aches and all. And it's weird because, like, your body temperature will go up, but when you get the chills when you have a fever. Really weird, right? Because when you get the chills, that encourages you take a hot bath, take a hot shower, and to bundle up more to continue to raise and keep your core temperature high in order to kill the virus. And eventually, the virus does get flushed out. The planet Earth is the host. Human beings, with our conquest of land and our burning of coal and fossil fuels, and the vast majority of third world countries are still burning wood and releasing all of these carbon emissions. And what it's doing is it's increasing the carbon footprint and the carbon dioxide that is underneath the Earth's atmosphere. And very slowly, the Earth is heating up because the polar ice caps are getting smaller and they're melting because Earth's core temperature is going up. Because what your polar ice caps do, they're like ice cubes in a drink of water. The more ice cubes you have, the colder and cooler and more predictable the temperature of your water is going to be. But once those ice cubes start to melt, and that's what's happening to our polar ice caps, because the sun's rays that come to Earth are being trapped underneath this film, this layer of all of the exhaust and all of the carbon emissions. Therefore, our polar ice caps, which act as the ice cubes in our drink, which acts as Earth's air conditioning, are starting to melt, and therefore the oceans are getting warmer, the seas are getting warmer, and that also contributes to these polar ice caps that are melting at a very, very rapid clip. The Earth is heating up to kill the virus, which is people. It is a phenomenon that is as old as nature itself. That is precisely what is happening, and you cannot escape that natural phenomenon. There will be a host. There will be a virus. Either the virus itself kills the host, or the host raises its temperature and kills the virus, and there is no in-between. You're listening to The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 101.7 FM. I'll be right back.
The Truth with Sherwin Hughes returns after this on 101.7 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com. This is The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 101.7 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com.
Al Walters says, where do I pick up these conversations that people are having in the YouTube chat? He says, I mean, come on, ass. We trust people every day. Every time you pull up to a fast food restaurant, you are trusting them to give you what you just paid for. How often are you disappointed, Al, by your experience at fast food restaurants? Either the food is of low quality, sometimes it's not what you ordered, or what about the customer service? It says, we trust people every day. Every time you pull up to a fast food restaurant, you are trusting them to give you what you just paid for. What if there's shrinkage? What if the sandwich you order got smaller? What if a small fry that you order got even smaller? Are you still satisfied? Do you go back to that restaurant because of that experience that you had? Does that erode your trust in that restaurant? I'll use myself as an example, which is not always the best one. But if I go to a new restaurant, which I'm often skeptical of, I like to read what other people say about a restaurant, but it's got to be people that I can relate to. Because what a 17 or 18-year-old might say about a restaurant and the decor and the food choices, because they might just like the fact that there's dino nuggets on the menu. I don't eat no damn dino nuggets. So if I'm listening to a 17 or 18-year-old review a restaurant, even if they say it's good, I may not like it. So I want to read the review of someone who might be a cohort of mine, age or generation-wise, okay? And then I'll go to the restaurant based on somebody else's review, which is still a calculated risk. And if I go to a new restaurant and I have a bad experience, I do not go back. Maybe that's a bad thing, and I know that we have to have patience when you go to a new restaurant, because maybe they got some growing pains, maybe they got some management issues, maybe somebody didn't show up for their shift. You're supposed to, this is what you're actually supposed to do, and this is, so the Jews do this, and if you want to follow their footsteps and how they support one another and support their businesses, this is actually a good rule of thumb. So Jewish people are going to support a Jewish business even if they receive poor quality and they receive poor service, because here's what they do. They go back and they say, hey, last time I was here, this was messed up, this was messed up, this is messed up. Fix it, and I'll buy again. And then they'll come back again another time, another week. Hey, last time I was here, a couple visits ago, I wanted you guys to fix this, 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 and this. And I did come back, and I spent money again. Did you fix it? Yes. Now you got a customer for life. What I do, and this speaks to me specifically because I also believe in competition, if a restaurant cannot provide good and consistent food quality and service and an overall experience every single time, randomly, a Sunday night, a Monday night, a Tuesday afternoon, 5 in the morning, 5 in the afternoon, if it's not consistent, then I'm just not going to go back. Because I don't have that kind of patience. And I know that there are other places that I have been to that are consistent no matter when you go. Doesn't matter when you go. Doesn't matter who's managing that day. Doesn't matter who the shift workers are. Doesn't matter who's on the line. Doesn't matter who's cooking. It is going to be consistent. And you can trust the consistency of that restaurant. But when it comes to new businesses and small businesses, especially Black businesses, if you believe in supporting them, because it's almost like a religion for some people, like, oh, I'm going to support Black-owned. I've fallen away from that only because saying a business is Black-owned, being a part of your sales pitch, means that you're already looking for an out if your quality and your service is lackluster, because you can say, oh, well, you know, we're Black-owned and we're out here struggling. It's almost like saying, like a mom who raised a son and just shot 4 people. But I was a single mother. I'm a single mother. It gives an excuse, like a pretext excuse for everything to be all messed up. And I just personally, I don't do that. I don't allow somebody to give me an excuse on the front end. I will support a business that gives me superb quality, good service, and convenience. I don't care who owns it. And Black people and white people and anybody else should have a monopoly on that if you're in business. White people don't have a monopoly on good service and good quality. But because they have been in business longer and they have gone through their growing pains and they know how to directly provide what the consumers want, they're a little bit more evolved sometimes in their business. But Black people should be able to participate in that too. If you're a Black-owned business, in fact, you should have an even higher standard of the food or whatever the case may be. This brings me to, I got to get into this damn poll about trust. Actually, let's see what we have on our YouTube poll. Yeah, it's pretty consistent. Can most people be trusted? 76% of you say nope, they cannot. 24% of you say yep, people can be trusted. The Marquette University poll basically says it depends on your age. If you were born before 1960, 77% of the people born before 19 people say most people can be trusted. Only 23% of people born before 1960 say most people cannot be trusted. That's a little nerve-wracking because the older someone is, the much more likely they are to be taken advantage, because 3/4 of them believe that most people can be trusted. If you were born in the 1960s, 63% of people born in the 1960s say that most people can be trusted. 37% of those born in the 1960s say people cannot be trusted. Let's get to my decade, the 1970s, 55% of us. Now, it's starting to get lower now. The younger you get, the less trust you have in other people. If you were born in the 1970s, 55% of us say most people can be trusted. So a shade over half of us, 45% of us say most people cannot be trusted. Here's where the big shift happens, and this is with the millennial generation. If you were born in the 1980s, 45%, so less than half of the people born in the 1980s, say that most people can be trusted. 55% of the people born in the 1980s say that most people can't be trusted. Imagine how this will impact our politics. So the younger someone is, the less likely they are to trust anybody, let alone a political party or any human being that is running for office. So if you look at that for what it's worth, the Democrats are a very established political party, at least since the realignment starting probably in 1948, give or take, when the Dixiecrats left the Democratic Party because they didn't like civil rights legislation, and they eventually migrated over to the Republican Party, really solidified by Barry Goldwater, who was the Republican nominee in 1964. And this was a big strike against Hillary Clinton, because Hillary Clinton in 1964 was either a campaign worker, a volunteer, or a delegate for Barry Goldwater. And he started grabbing those Southern Democrats and bringing them over to the Republican Party. It's very simple. So whenever somebody says, oh, you know, the Democrats are the party of slavery, that's like knowing only the first quarter in a football game and thinking that you know the entire score. No. There was a realignment that took place. Whenever somebody says that, stop talking to them, because they are completely ignorant of history, and you're just going to get angry at them because they're just going to prove to be even dumber. As Democratic elected officials, especially in Congress, started to embrace ending Jim Crow and supporting voting rights and employment rights for black people and educational rights, because a lot of colleges and universities would not admit black people, as more and more Democrats in the South said, no, we need to be more open on civil rights, then more of those racist segregationist Democrats went to the Republican Party. Solidified with the Southern strategy implemented by Richard Nixon, he basically says, okay, come and be a Republican. I'm going to show you a kind of racism that you have never seen before. We're going to be more effective at punishing black people. And Richard Nixon was basically campaigning and said, your Democratic Party has failed you, because look at all the civil rights these blacks have. Look what your Democratic Party has become. And a lot of the Southerners that were still holdouts were like, okay, well, let's give this guy Nixon a shot. Nixon is going to create a whole new way to discriminate, because when Jim Crow ended, racism didn't. It had to evolve. And it did so very elegantly. And one of the unfortunate things about Richard Nixon, if you look at the intelligence levels and the IQ scores of American presidents, Nixon is easily in the top 10, if not the top 5. Dude was brilliant. Sinister, evil genius, got impeached, was about to literally be removed from office, and decided to quit. He flew away on a helicopter. He was like, hey, effective noon tomorrow, I'm out of here. I'm going to quit. Because he knew that it would damage the Republican Party for a whole generation if he was actually impeached by his own party. So he was impeached in the House, and the Senate had enough votes to literally remove him from office. It would have been the first time in American history that has ever happened. And Richard Nixon was like, well, it's not going to be me. I'm going to leave on my own terms. I'm going to get on a helicopter and just fly away. Richard Nixon said, okay, the Democrats have disappointed you. Come and vote for me. I'm a Republican. But there were still some holdouts, right? Even those Southern racist Dixiecrats, like, well, we don't know. You know, Republican Party is the party that freed the slaves. Could you imagine that conversation? Talking to a Southern Democrat in 1968 that was skeptical of the Republican Party because they didn't think the Republican Party was racist enough, because back then, 100 years prior to, the Republican Party were the Union soldiers and the Union generals that went and Juneteenth Day, and General Granger that went down to Galveston. Oh, by the way, Tom Tiffany doesn't believe in any of this, by the way. He's anti-Juneteenth Day, which, whatever. He can be anti-Juneteenth Day, and I don't care, just like Francesca Hong can want to cancel Thanksgiving. I'm still going to celebrate them both. That's just one person's opinion. I don't care about stuff like that. That's trivial to me. I care about education, but we'll get to that later. Richard Nixon said, okay, we can't just attack black people because that's now illegal. We can't segregate them. We can't segregate the schools because that's illegal. There's federal laws that prevent that. Nixon said, we're going to come up with something new. What if it's not a war on blackness? What if it's not a war on actual people that we don't like? What if it's a war on drugs? And the Southern Dixiecrats are like, we're listening. It's like if black people consume drugs like marijuana, we are going to increase the penalties and schedule marijuana, which everybody smoked. But it really was motivated by not just African-Americans who may, and everybody smoked weed, but it was also anti-Vietnam War protesters and hippies that Richard Nixon wanted to lump together, and the war was against them. It was a culture war. And then you start to have this thing called the silent majority, and they didn't like all this protesting. They didn't like all this civil rights stuff. They didn't like Dr. Martin Luther King. They also didn't like their kids on these college campuses and universities protesting the Vietnam War, because the Vietnam War was a war that was supposed to assert American dominance and American capitalism and American military might on every single part of the world, including Southeast Asia. We are an imperialist nation, and you better support the Vietnam War, which was arguably the worst foreign policy decision in the history of this nation. They sent 50-some thousand men and women to die. The war was over in 1968 when Walter Cronkite said the war is unwinnable. Lyndon Johnson didn't run for re-election because of what Walter Cronkite said, because he said if you lost Cronkite, you lost America. This goes back to trust. People born before 1960, 75% of them are very trusting. You know who people really used to trust? The media. That is why when you're talking to an older person, God bless them, they'll read something on the internet, it'll be completely fake news, and they'll believe it because they come from an era where if something was in a media outlet, it had to be true, because America actually was known for honest journalism. Now it's all been taken over by corporations. Very, very fascinating stuff. Really is. So here comes Richard Nixon. And the Republican Party has not looked back since. You're listening to The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 101.7 FM. I'll be right back.
Don't touch that dial. The Truth with Sherwin Hughes will be right back on 101.7 The Truth, The Truth app, and 101.7thetruth.com. You are listening to The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 101.7 The Truth, The Truth app, and 101.7thetruth.com.
Phone number, you want to call or whatever, text message, 833-212-1017, 833-212-1017. We have a new, like, text message feature, which they did this thing now where, like, I got to log into my email and then the text messages that you send to 833-212-1017 come to my phone. But I didn't, they switched it over and didn't tell me. All of a sudden, my phone is blowing up and I'm getting text messages that people are... So my show was off the air, but I'm still getting text messages from other shows. I was like, ugh, I don't want that. So I turned it off. So if you're texting that number.
I understand your feelings.
So I don't know. If I guess just call or, well, some people are nervous. Bob's not nervous. Bob doesn't even care what he says a lot of the times. Go to YouTube, I guess. YouTube chat. You got to be careful of the Kelda Roy's supporters. And so one of them was in our YouTube chat. So they have a strategy. So she has deployed her supporters. Her supporters they kind of remind me of Francesca's supporters because they're very dug in. Like, they're really super committed. I think there's something about Madison folk. When they vote for somebody and they elect them and reelect them, they really believe in them. So if you live in Kelda's Senate district, which Francesca does, those Kelda supporters are, like, gung-ho for her. And so their strategy is they're going to go into every comment section on every social media post. And once I tell you this, you're not going to be able to unsee it. So whenever there's a news article talking about the primary race for governor, Kelda supporters will say, Kelda's the most qualified person in the race. She's ready to go on day one. It's almost like they're a bunch of robots, but they're not robots. These are actual people, and they believe. This is why our campaign strategy is just, it's laughable. They think that that's going to have an actual impact on voters. Too much emphasis has been put on advertising via social media. I know that's where you reach an awful lot of people. But if it's not met with something that's in person, like somebody attending a rally or a town hall meeting where the community is invited, then I don't know if just promoting your campaign on television or via social media is going to be enough, because it seems very distant and people want to have some kind of connection with the people that they're voting for. Because here's the thing, you probably will never meet them. You'll probably never see them. But it's nice to have them, like, come into the community and do an event where they're a little bit more approachable. Because once they get elected and they're in Madison all the time, you're not going to see them. And so if your campaign is hiding behind a screen, it can diminish your potential effectiveness in convincing voters. Like, I don't know if I could ever support a candidate for public office that's only, I only see them in my Instagram feed. If they're not actually doing things, if they're not actually showing up, if they're not in person, hey, we're going to be in Milwaukee this weekend, or hey, we're going to be in South Milwaukee or Cudahy, or we're going to be somewhere. That means a lot. I think Fran has done a fantastic job. Her campaign has been great, but she's also had a lot of liberty with what she can say. I think if there's a strike against establishment Democrats, they are not going to overpromise, because Democrats have been found guilty and indicted on overpromising and under-delivering, because they can rarely take into account how the Republicans are going to push back on their agenda. So whatever a Democrat is running on, it could be, I don't know, healthcare, public education, jobs, the economy, raising minimum wage. The Republicans are writing all of that down, and they're going to say, yeah, we're never going to let any of that happen. And I think this is where politics gets very tough and hard for regular folks to understand. Even if it is a good idea, raising wages, at the end of the day, probably a good idea. Making homeownership more affordable, probably a really good idea. What else is a good idea? I don't know, women's reproductive rights.
Medicare for all.
Medicare for all, Xavier says, probably a good idea. But if it's a good idea and it's a Democratic idea, the Republicans are not going to support it. Republicans are not going to say, you know what, Democrats, that's a great idea. Let us work with you on having Medicare for all and raising the minimum wage and making home ownership more affordable and bringing down inflation. Let's work with you. Hey, everybody, the Democrats have a fantastic idea. And the Republicans are now going to join in and work with the Democrats on their agenda. And what will happen is, like, holy smokes, they work together. Bipartisanship is a beautiful thing. The legislation passes. People can afford their groceries. And homeownership is becoming less expensive. There's less barriers. Wages are going up. The Democrats will run for reelection on that agenda. And they'll say, hey, the Republicans helped us do this. People will just vote for Democrats. They won't say, the Republicans helped, but no, they were Democratic ideas. Why would you ever vote for a Republican? So the Republican agenda, at least in the meantime, now it's gonna run out, because eventually you got to do stuff and prove to the people that you're worthy of earning their vote. But they have been an opposition party. Democrats have really good ideas because their tent is bigger and they want to help more people. They want to help too many damn people, and they go a little bit too far. Like, use whatever bathroom you like. Hey. If I go into the men's bathroom and I see a woman squatting in the urinal, like we're all facing the wall. Because when you're using a urinal, you're all facing the same way. The wall. We're peeing in a thing that's connected to the wall. Right? But then let's just say there's a woman. Well, she can't pee facing the wall. She's got to sit down. Now she's facing the opposite direction. But she's a man, though, so she can. It's really funny to think about that. I'll be looking at him like, hey, ma'am. I'm not a ma'am. I'm a sir. Just because I'm sitting down and peeing and I'm facing the opposite direction that you all are doesn't mean that I'm less of a man than you. I'm proud of a bit of an extreme example.
Yeah, that's pretty extreme.
But our politics are, in fact, extreme. Like, something as silly as that could move 7 million voters in the United States of America. But the bottom line is, so for regular American people that are struggling, that are suffering, you unfortunately are falling victim to the lack of bipartisanship, because if one political party gets credit for creating a policy that helps you, then that political party is going to do much better. Republicans can't do that. Also, Republicans have got to be very careful of allowing Democrats to rack up political wins, because the demographic of people that typically vote for Republicans, like, they're losing people. One of the reasons why they try to ban abortion by overturning Roe, they didn't really ban it, they just left it up to the states. But whenever you leave stuff up to the states, please keep this in mind when you're understanding American history and politics. When you leave certain things up to the states, when the federal government, the federal government is not like the nanny, the big babysitter, the parent, then states will do crazy stuff, okay? States will still maintain slavery. People will run on quote-unquote states' rights. So the federal government is like, yo, you can't, we're going to try and keep everybody under control here. States, you can't go crazy. And the states are like, why not? We want slaves, please. And the federal government, like, as the big nanny, is like, no, you can't. No. Fine. So the federal government told states, oh, you guys can do whatever you want when it comes to abortion. You can monitor women's little period apps. You can do all sorts. You can track them with flock cameras if they go out of state to get an abortion. You can fire them. You can do all sorts of stuff. That was to try to slow the number of white women now that are having abortions, because white women, there's more white women uteruses in America than any other uterus. So if a white woman gets pregnant, give birth to a white baby. In order to have white nationalism and white supremacy, you got to have white women having white babies. And white women are just like, ah, we don't want to have babies anymore. We want to be rich. We want to be childless. We also found that in 32 or 33 metropolitan areas where women don't have children, guess what? They make the same money as men. So a lot of women are like, oh, yeah, I don't want any kids because they're expensive and they're generally kind of gross. And, you know, they do stuff to your body. That's just the mechanics of having a baby is really, really scary. How do you squeeze out like a medium-sized watermelon out of something that really is like the size of a little coin purse, right? I wouldn't try to carry a watermelon in a coin purse. You know what I mean? How do you, that's, whoop. I could understand. If I was a woman, I'd be like, just take my uterus out today. Put it, like, frame it. Put it in a jar. I don't need this thing. I don't want to get pregnant. But get pregnant by a man that can just leave? No way. So to punish women, white women, for having abortions because they have more than anybody else, they're like, oh, we're going to overturn Roe. We're going to leave it up to the states. And then maybe, just maybe, some white women who don't have access to birth control, which is a healthcare issue, maybe more of them will get pregnant and we'll have more white babies, because white men need more white boys to be born in order to maintain their supremacy. But it also was to show that white women are so low on the totem pole that they're going to take something that impacts, it impacts all women, but white women in particular. White men were like, yeah, we're shut up. We're going to take your right away, and there's nothing you're going to do about it. And what do white women do? Still voted for Republicans. That right there is probably the biggest impediment to our progress. White women just won't, they won't vote for Democrats. The Truth with Sherwin Hughes will be right back.
Don't touch that dial. The Truth with Sherwin Hughes will be right back on 1017 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com. This is The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 1017 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com.
Peggy Hedberg, a Madison resident, recently switched her support in the Democratic primary for governor from State Senator Kel DeRoyes to Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley, a decision she said she has made because, quote, pragmatically, she wants to vote for someone to win. Roy's has been polling in the single digits. Hedberg said it was Crowley's energy that won her over. Quote, I felt like he had the strength to carry us, she said, noting that it was hard for her to switch. She said she cares about electing women, especially as abortion access is one of the most important issues to her, but she also cares about having a candidate who can work with the legislature to get things done. She says, I had to make a decision, and it was hard, but I felt that with Evers backing and other factors that this would be a better way for us to move forward. Today is the last day. Hold on. Today's the last day you can register to vote if you want to vote early in person. Here it is. What's today? August what now? 7th. Damn, August is flying by. State Fair is here. Back to school soon. You know what that means. Book bag giveaways. We're going to make sure that the kids have all the book bags. First of all, I think I had the same backpack from 4th grade until 8th grade. I didn't get a new backpack every year. These kids get new backpacks every single year. We do so many backpack giveaways. I do love how we support our school children. We get them all the supplies and all the things they need and all the folders and the pencils and the pens and the colored pens and the pencils and the crayons. And if you got the 64-pack of crayons, you got all the colors. And we give them the backpack. Sometimes we even give away computers and whatever. The kids can't read, but at least they're going to have stuff for when they do learn how to read. Some of it is like, yeah, we want our kids to be successful, but also good. Get out of here. Go back to school. I'm sick of you hanging around the house eating all the food all day. So I think that we send them off with everything that they need to hope that they're going to actually be successful. Okay. The last day in which we have information was yesterday, Thursday, August 6th. 140 people voted at the Good Hope Library. 9 people registered to vote. At the Midtown Voting Center yesterday alone, 226 people voted. 13 new people registered to vote. The Tippecanoe Library, 193 people voted. 9 registered to vote. Washington Park, 100 people voted early. 9 registered to vote. The Zablocki Library, 137 people voted. There was 1 new registrant. And at the Zeidler Municipal Building yesterday, 271 people voted. That's not bad. 25 new people registered. The daily total for yesterday alone at the early voting sites in Milwaukee was 1,067 votes cast, 61 people registered. How many people have voted early so far? So this is not including today. So far, since early voting started on July 28th, so 2 weeks ago, 7,054 ballots have been cast and 338 people have registered. That's not a lot, considering we have 290, I'm just going to say 300,000, either registered and or eligible voters in the city of Milwaukee. Now, a lot of people are going to vote on Election Day, absolutely. And this also does not count people that may have voted by mail. But that number is typically pretty small, too, probably less than 10,000 people. But this is going to be a low turnout election. The Truth with Sherwin Hughes will be back for Hour 3.
The Truth with Sherwin Hughes returns after this on 1017 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com.